Good morning. So my topic today is really getting at our panel theme from the perspective of bioethics. Not so empirical, not so much attention, although some attention to public health strategies, but trying to get into this via some of the ways we look at, think about chronic illness. And this is a work in progress. And one of the things that I've been thinking about is the relationship between solidarity in the community and chronicity with respect to illness. So I look forward to your questions and comments. Now let's, I'm going to have to do both of them here. Oh, I'll get it. Okay. So nothing to disclose. Okay. So in 1988, our colleague Bruce Jennings and his Hastings Center colleagues Dan Callahan and Art Kaplan published a report on the ethical challenges of chronic illness that is just one of those Hastings Center hits that keeps on giving, because practically everything in it still applies today. And they described the study of chronic illness as a tedious, grinding labor of Sisyphus. Now, does that not sound attractive? Like that boulder that keeps crashing back down on Sisyphus, the study of chronic illness is a topic that one must keep at, knowing that, like chronic illness, it will always be with us. Now, chronic illness, as we know, doesn't sound sexy. There are no TV dramas called Outpatient Clinic, for example. Although, imagine, you know. And yet, Jennings, Callahan, and Kaplan make two key points about the ethics of what I'm going to call chronicity, encompassing both the experience of chronic illness as it's lived by a person and how we conceptualize the idea of a disease being or becoming chronic. I'm going to use cancer as my particular example, particularly when we know that this disease is also progressive and likely to be the cause of this person's death. One point that Jennings and colleagues make is that ethical challenges arise in community and chronic care settings, not only in the ICU. Now, this seems obvious. They made this point back in 1988, which was pretty good. Except this is not how ethics services have been organized to date. They're organized as if everything happens in the ICU or the NICU or where. Anywhere else. And it is really hard for providers in the community to get to ethics services, even when they're quite good. And often they are not. The other point is that because people live with chronic illness for years or even for decades, the philosopher's question, how ought we to live, may be explored more productively with reference to chronic illness than with reference to acute illness. And yet that is not the orientation of a lot of the bioethics literature. You know, I find it more interesting to think about what people live with and what they tell us about what they're living with, even if it is overlapping with what they are dying from. So Tim set up these slides very nicely. The next two is why focus on cancer in this area of inquiry? One is that the projected rate of global deaths for cancer is going up, as other preventable causes of illness and mortality go down. Everything from road traffic accidents flattening out, other infectious diseases, HIV/AIDS plateauing. So you see cancer rising and continuing to rise. Also, as Tim mentioned, cancer is strongly age associated. So it is not only a developed world problem, it is also a developing world problem. As life expectancy increases, you always see the incidence of cancer increasing in a population. So in the United States, about 12 million people are living today with a prior diagnosis of cancer. And if you were at the CDC, you would say this is the survivor number. It's hard to tell how many of these individuals are living with cancer right now, because this number includes anyone with a prior diagnosis who isn't dead yet. So that number includes people who have been cured of cancer and it's not going to come back. Some have incurable disease. That would include the hospice population, the hospice-eligible population. Some have disease that will turn out to be recurrent, but we don't know this yet. Maybe an oncologist knows it, but maybe the patient is living with the possibility that the disease has been cured. As a bridge from population to patient, from the 2 million to the 1 and then back, and specifically to the patient I'm particularly interested in, which is the chronically ill person who is living with cancer in the community, not in the hospital. I want to use a case to help us get at how difficult it can be to define chronicity with respect to cancer and how this plays out in the context of decision-making, care planning over time. So what does cancer as a chronic illness look like? Okay, so here's a case. So JB is a 41-year-old self-employed printer and designer. She's married with two young children, and she's diagnosed with breast cancer. She finds a lump herself. She's clear mammograms, which happens sometimes with younger women. Her cancer is diagnosed at stage 2 due to positive lymph nodes, so it's an aggressive disease already. It's somewhat hormone positives, which means that this increases her treatment options in some way because of the nature of the cancer. Her treatment includes the standard lumpectomy, a particular chemotherapy regimen, and radiation, with no evidence of disease, NED, following treatment. Now, her post-treatment effects include lymphedema, due to the lymph node involvement in her right arm. This causes her to lose income because she loses range of motion in her arm. Her profession is as a printer. She works on 19th century presses. She can't do this anymore, lifting this really heavy thing down. So the profession that she trained in for 20 years is effectively over for her. She sucks it up. She has two children. And she sort of switches her focus to the other part of her business, which is graphic design on computers. She receives ongoing hormonal therapy to prevent recurrence. Now, she already has a chronic problem right here. She's got pain, she needs physical therapy, and of course the effects are going to have a huge impact on her work life as well. Now, 3 years after her first diagnosis, her cancer recurs. It's at a very rare and aggressive stage at this point. Oncologists don't see this presentation very often. It's a very arduous course of treatment. She experiences significant cancer-related pain because the cancer is growing so quickly, and treatment side effects because there's a great deal of chemotherapy and surgery and radiation. At this point, she enrolls in her cancer centers, and she's being treated at a big cancer center, their pain management service to address her increasingly complex palliative care needs. What's interesting is the first time she asked her oncologist and the nurse about, well, can I do something about the pain, the answer she received was, well, we're not there yet. So it was kept, it was almost a turf issue that by making a referral to pain management, it was not something that the oncologists were used to. So they continued to treat her pain based on what they knew about pain, which was not very much. But eventually she persevered and was able to be formally enrolled in the pain management service. But it was always an awkward integration. After multimodal therapy, she is again NED, but it's very cautious because that cancer was so aggressive. It's NED for now. We can't find anything right now. She gets further hormonal therapy. She has her ovary surgically removed, again, to reduce the amount of hormones in her system. She resumes working part-time on freelance projects. Her marriage ends. She is able to obtain private insurance because she was insured on her husband's policy through a self-insurance program for freelancers that's available in her state and not other states. This replaces her coverage through her former spouse's employer. Interestingly enough, this insurance program, which is called the Freelancers Union, they make a point of saying that their insurance covers cancer care because they realize that that is a huge reason why a freelancer would suddenly seek out a policy, that they get a bad diagnosis. And she becomes the custodial parent of her children. Now, she has a second recurrence 2 years after her first recurrence, and at this point she's formally, it is incurable. It's at stage 4, although this was always suspected before. After receiving hormonal therapy, and then those options are exhausted because they tend to use the hormonal therapies to treat the disease because there's less burden on the system. She begins long-term chemotherapy, including oral chemotherapy. Now, oral chemotherapy is self-managed therapy. The patient is told to take this at home. This is pretty scary when you're formerly chemotherapy involved going to a clinic, being seen by your oncologist, being seen by chemo nurses, being stuck in your port, and on, suddenly it's you and the bottle. So, but that is something that cancer patients increasingly take on board, and it's seen as less burdensome, but in some ways it can up the burden because it is such a tremendous responsibility on the patient. And it also means that the patient doesn't have and doctors or nurses' eyes on them with respect to their palliative care needs. So you're calling, you're faxing, you're emailing, you're doing anything you can to try to keep your team in the loop when it's you at home. The first and line second chemotherapy drugs are somewhat effective in slowing progression, but a year and a half after the second recurrence, JB experiences symptoms of progression in her chest cavity, including pain and pleural effusion of the collection of fluid on her lung. The effusion is surgically treated, resulting in a week-long hospitalization and a slow recovery. So her overall health is getting worse. And of course, any of these things are adding to the chronic burden. Now, the third and fourth line drugs fail to slow progression at all, and scans reveal progression. She experiences fatigue, pain, breathing difficulties. She's no longer able to work, or at least not for pay. She continues to raise her children with help from family and friends. Now, she has long expressed her prognosis in general terms, especially since that second recurrence. She says, I know I'm going to die of this someday. She's long been clear with her oncologist about her values and preferences and her concerns as a now single parent. I need to parent my children to get those life lessons in. For example, I was going to teach my daughter how to make crepes when she got her first apartment. We'll do it now, even though she's 12. I want to stay out of the hospital. It's very disruptive for my children, for obvious reasons. And always, I need to make plans, so I need you to be as clear as possible with me. Now, 7 years after this initial diagnosis, she's scheduled to meet with her oncologist to review her most recent scans, which confirm what everyone knows, that the fourth line chemotherapy has failed. With this patient, it's about 11th line chemotherapy because of all the previous chemotherapies. The realistic options now include an off-label drug, which is likely to be significantly more toxic than past drugs, or foregoing further interventions and continuing palliative care, as it has been to date, by enrolling in hospice in the community, or transferring to her cancer center's palliative care service, which is also can be done. You can just become followed by palliative care rather than leaving the system. Now, there are no data suggesting that this fifth-line chemotherapy will increase her overall survival. And given her history of chemorefractory disease as well, it's, as the patient herself would say, they don't save the best for last. Data on any potential benefit of the proposed off-label drug are scant, practically non-existent. So this is, of course, something that ought to be shared with the patient rather than saying, well, there's another thing we can try. Okay, great, no problem. Now, her oncologist, in all of these conversations, characterizes the patient's values and preferences as she wants to stay alive for her children, which isn't quite the same thing as saying, I want to parent my children. And it really, with respect to the community, it's the difference between perhaps being in the hospital and being at home. The oncologist characterizes herself as a hopeful person, very common in oncology. There's quite a lot of literature on this. This has consequences for how oncologists look at individual patients and their relationship to their patients. The oncologist has never explicitly presented discharge to hospice or transfer to palliative care as treatment options over this seven-year course. What would it mean to do this? Off-label chemo is not necessarily covered by insurance. JB has incurred $30,000 in unreimbursed medical expenses related to the two most recent regimens alone, never mind previous years, both of which completely failed to provide benefit. A lot of those, that $30,000 is for side effects. It's to cover this drug or that drug because of the burden of the medications on one system. So they're in effect palliative care drugs, even though they're you know, for nausea or for white blood cells or whatever it may be, but it's to allow one to cope with the illness. After 7 years, chronic illness is very familiar to this woman and her children. Her younger child cannot remember a time when her mother didn't have cancer. And she has chosen to continue treatment many times. So the orientation of all of this is toward that off-label drug. Now, just giving this quickly, that's, you know, to have a picture in what mind of what chronic cancer would look like, what are some of the characteristics of a chronic disease? We talk about duration, medical needs, and functional limitations, all of which we saw in this case. But defining chronicity in cancer can be very difficult, even though there's a wonderful report that just came out from Lancet Oncology saying, you know, health economists are now referring to cancer as a chronic disease because of the way it is managed and paid for. It doesn't necessarily mean we've locked it down like diabetes or asthma. It's quite different. So it's in play quite a bit. A very few number of cancers can be managed as chronic diseases and be stabilized. However, as the Lancet reports, few treatments are clear winners, with many falling into the category of substantial cost for limited benefit. Some oncologists use the term chronic to characterize disease that is potentially stable. But again, that could really be a euphemism for a progressive disease. And as the Lancet notes, health economists now label cancer as a chronic disease just because of its prevalence in the population. So what's our ethical framework for thinking about cancer and chronicity? Among the recognized ethical goals of primary care and cancer care is for clinicians to help patients accommodate the burdens of living with a serious disease, to put it out there. You know, this is what it means to have chronic asthma, chronic diabetes, hypertension, so that the patient's life is not solely defined by illness. But oncology professionals have not yet agreed on an ethical framework for managing cancer as a chronic disease in the specialty care net context that a cancer patient would need. Also, the chronic disease paradigm for primary care emphasizes patient self-management, the clinician's responsibility to support the patient, knowing that this person is going to be living in the community, not living in the hospital. Cancers differ from many other chronic diseases because they adapt and become resistant to treatment. Change is the norm. So there's a lot of psychological and practical burden that comes on board when you have to have these huge shifts in treatment regimens. Compliance, being a perfect patient, may never prevent recurrence and progression in cancer. So communications about chronicity in cancer care, and obviously you can see that I'm hoping that oncologists would address this issue much earlier on. If we define chronic cancer as not curable but treatable, may the patient's prognosis be unclear. What's the difference between a chronic disease and a chronic illness? That can be difficult if we put illness on the palliative care service. Then it's never properly addressed in the treatment context, and that's difficult. I think of this as the lunch table problem of different providers in the same institution do not talk with one another. And of course, sometimes clinicians use the word chronic to refer to a place where care is provided. It can be a synonym for community, but it can also be a synonym for sort of invisible and sort of out there. So the outpatient cancer care setting that works really well when you have early stage disease and a short course of treatment and you go back home can be the place where you have to hang out over and over again over the course of being treated for chronic cancer. I've mentioned earlier, it's very unclear how ethics reaches clinicians in the community because it is so much organized as an inpatient ICU crisis service in many institutions. And if it's organized as an inpatient service, its benefits are not available to chronically ill patients who knows, their oncologists may be facing ethical dilemmas, but it isn't clear how anyone benefits from this service. I will be wrapping up. If we acknowledge, at least in the primary care framework, that chronic disease is self-managed care to some extent, what is owed to the patient responsible for the self-management of cancer treatment? And who is responsible for identifying and helping to coordinate the foreseeable palliative care needs of cancer patients because of all this treatment burden? When does self-managed care require unpaid or paid caregivers, and who bears these costs? And who is responsible for talking about treatment costs? This is a huge issue in clinical oncology right now. As soon as you mention off-label, you're probably mentioning something that is not covered by insurance. So cancer centers, at least in the United States, are organized to serve the needs of patients who can benefit from interventions aimed to cure cancer or prevent recurrence. But we're not quite there with respect to comprehensive cancer care, which must also encompass the needs of chronically ill patients whose numbers are foreseeable, whose needs are foreseeable. Managing cancer and cancer-related symptoms in a chronic illness framework calls for medical and organizational systems that complement but are different from systems for patients who are completing cancer treatment and will be done and will officially be survivors, and also for patients who are near the end of life, even though the chronically ill patient, except in a few rare cases, is probably also a progressively ill patient and is probably going to be hospice eligible at some point. Survivorship programs are geared to post-treatment needs. They're unlikely to meet the needs of a person who is living with cancer. The person living with cancer may not even be eligible for a survivor program. Now, the other thing is, while I've been talking about cancer being exceptional in some ways, a recent report from the Dartmouth Atlas points out that if you study how cancer is managed, at least in the hospital setting, you're probably going to learn something about how other chronic diseases are managed in the same hospital. So it's a way of using cancer as an index case, but into other concerns. So that's a new report. And so back to Sisyphus, and I want to make a few points, and then I promise I will end up. I thought this was going to be so short. So Jennings, Callahan, and Kaplan point out, and I think this follows nicely on Tim's remarks, is that when you meet the needs of persons with chronic illness, you are treating them as full-fledged members of the moral community, but also of the actual community, acknowledging that people with cancer and other chronic diseases are people who are living among us. That is a public health message. And I'd like to suggest that solidarity may be a useful principle or goal here. In public health ethics in the United States, solidarity is sometimes invoked in the sense of we're all in this together. During this disaster, we all rely on the public health systems to get us through. But between disasters, and especially when we get into the public sphere, we tend to think of solidarity as rather European, not us. That's for them over there in Denmark. I've come to find it useful and attractive in thinking about interpersonal relationships between a currently healthy person and a currently sick person. What does it mean for me to be in solidarity with my sick friend who may feel empathy or compassion as pity, doesn't like those words, who is my equal as a person, and who wants to keep things as equitable as possible between us? Can a person with cancer and a person who does not have cancer be in this together for as long as this lasts? And further, can a community be in this together with respect to how it addresses cancer and other chronic illnesses as things that are going on in the community, as things that some of us will always live with as long as we live, and that all of us should recognize as part of our common life? These are not the heroic stories about community members beating cancer, yet everyone in that woman's town knew she had cancer. This is not that story. But the end-of-life story may not yet work for the person who is living with cancer but does not yet perceive themselves to be dying of cancer, even if this is a distance of weeks, months, or a few years. So with that non-conclusion, just want to mention in the slides, which I think you'll get, there's a number of different readings. Bottomer, Lorigan, colleagues, that's the classic ethical framework for the management of chronic diseases. And this is the Lancet Oncology study that I just mentioned. I also want to, there's a recent small publication on the Hastings Center website, which is meant for consumers and patients and care partners, ethical questions about sharing information. It's free. So if you're looking for something that might be useful to the non-clinician or the other non-specialist, we're hoping to address that need. So, and yes, a plug for our end-of-life guidelines, which will be coming in 2012. Thank you very much.